Okay, let's unpack this right out of the gate. We are about to step onto a pretty intense battlefield today. And I don't mean a metaphorical, polite debate where people sip tea and just agree to disagree. I mean a scorched earth, take no prisoners, theological war zone.
That is honestly probably the most accurate way to describe the stack of documents we have on the table right now. It is a battlefield. And the casualties, well, according to the author of this text anyway, are the very souls of the believers.
You know, usually when we do these deep dives into religious history or like textual analysis, there's a certain vibe we expect.
Right.
It's usually academic, maybe a little dry, very respectful. It's very much, on the one hand, Rabbi X says this, and then on the other hand, Rabbi Y says that. But the source text you've brought for us today, it feels like someone is just flipping over tables in the study hall.
It really does feel that way. And that's because the text we are unpacking today isn't just a calm explanation of Judaism. It is a polemic, a very aggressive one. It's a fierce argument that claims a huge portion of what people consider mainstream Orthodox Judaism today is not just wrong, but actually dangerous.
Dangerous. Like, in what way?
Dangerous as in spiritually fatal, as in bordering on literal idolatry.
Wow. Okay, that is a massive claim. I want to make sure I get the title of this source text right because, I mean, even the title sounds like a challenge. It's called Order of Debate. Who is Samael? Who is Lilith? So, what are foreign gods?
Correct. And if that wasn't enough of a hook, the subtitle kind of gives away the game immediately. It reads, "Views on the foundations of the true religion and presentation of a debate in which the lie is completely shattered."
The lie is completely shattered. Yeah, that is not subtle at all. This author is clearly not here to make friends.
No, absolutely not. The author is here to purge. The central tension we're looking at here is between two very distinct worldviews within Judaism. On one side, you have what this source explicitly calls the truth, which is rationalist Judaism. This is the framework grounded in the Talmud and the writings of Maimonides, who is also known as the Rambam.
Right, the great medieval philosopher.
Yeah.
And on the other side,
On the other side, you have the main target of this text, which is the Kabbalistic worldview. So we're talking about the belief in demons, reincarnation, magic, amulets, and, supernatural intermediaries. The source argues that these aren't just harmless extra beliefs or colorful folk traditions. It argues that they are foreign pagan influences that have basically infiltrated the religion and corrupted it from the inside out.
so really, the mission of this deep dive today is to see exactly how this source deconstructs these mystical ideas. Because we're talking about things that are pretty culturally entrenched. Things like the demon Samael, the figure of Lilith, the concept of the evil eye, and even the idea of coming back for a second life.
Exactly. The source's core argument is that these aren't just cute stories. It argues that if you believe in demons or reincarnation, you're actually violating the core principles of monotheism. You're stepping away from the original Torah and stepping directly toward paganism.
Which is such a heavy accusation, but I think to really understand it, we have to start where the source starts. And it opens with this fascinating warning about the medium itself, a warning about books.
Yes, this is the foundation of the whole argument. The source makes a really compelling point right out of the gate. It says just because something is written in a book, even a really old book, even a Hebrew book found sitting in a synagogue, that does not magically make it true.
Which, sounds pretty obvious to us today in the age of the internet where we're constantly told not to believe everything we read. But in a highly traditional religious context, the phrase it is written usually just ends the argument right there.
Right, exactly. It is written as usually the ultimate trump card, but the source brings in Maimonides, the Rambam, writing a letter to his student Joseph, and Maimonides is just incredibly frustrated. You can practically feel the heat coming off the page. He's dealing with these critics, people he literally calls fools, who are attacking his rational, philosophical approach simply because they have some old books that say otherwise.
I really love the tone here. Maimonides writes something like, "I know that my work will be attacked by those who want to show they are greater." And he says he wrote his work for God alone, to save a nation that was, quote, without true views.
Without true views. That is the absolute key phrase there. Maimonides, and by extension, the author of our source text today, believed that the people had completely lost their way. They were just drowning in superstition. The source actually quotes the Epistle to Yemen, where Maimonides flat out says, "Fools accept anything written down as fact."
Yeah, he compares a liar with a pen to a liar with a tongue. Right.
Exactly. He's saying that just because ink hits paper doesn't magically create truth. A lie is a lie, whether you speak it or write it down in a fancy manuscript.
It's interesting because there's this built-in human assumption that if a book has survived for 500 or 1,000 years, it must be holy, or at least it must be somewhat correct.
And the rationalist response to that is a hard no. A lie can survive just as long as the truth if people enjoy the lie.
Right, if it's a good story.
If the lie is comforting or exciting or spooky, people will absolutely preserve it. Maimonides is essentially saying, use your brain. Does this text make sense? Does it align with the absolute unity of God? If not, I don't care how old the book is or who supposedly wrote it, throw it out.
And the source text goes even further than just calling these beliefs foolish. It says there's a severe historical consequence to all this. It claims this isn't just a victimless crime of believing silly things.
This is what the author calls the consequence of error. The source argues that the destruction of the temple, the long exile of the Jewish people, all of that massive historical suffering stemmed directly from this very issue.
Wait, really? That's the cause they point to?
Yes. It cites Maimonides saying that our ancestors sinned precisely because they found what he calls books of vanity. These were ancient idolatrous texts that were masquerading as deep wisdom, and the ancestors followed them. They thought they were being wise, deep, and mystical by studying star charts and demonology, but they were actually just abandoning God.
That is a staggering claim about history. So the argument is basically we lost our homeland not because we are religious enough, but because we were being religious in the entirely wrong way.
Precisely. Because we mistook those books that lie for the true tradition, we thought we were unlocking the hidden secrets of the cosmos, but we were actually just practicing idolatry.
So if those are the books that lie, how does this source define the actual truth? Like, what is the true tradition or the Masorah, according to this rationalist view?
The source defines it very, very strictly. The true tradition is the written Torah and the oral Torah, but it defines the oral Torah strictly as the Mishnah, the two Talmuds, Babylonian and Jerusalem, and the writings of the Geonim.
The Geonim being the heads of the academies in Babylon shortly after the Talmud was closed, right?
Right. And that's it. That is the boundary of the true tradition.
And everything else that came after.
Everything else is highly suspect, specifically the later mystical writings. The source clearly implies that the Zohar and the writings of the Arizal, what is often referred to in these texts as the New Kabbalah, actually contradict the original tradition.
So it's a matter of hierarchy.
Yes. If the Talmud says one thing and the Zohar says another, the rational source says the Zohar is just wrong. The later mystical text absolutely cannot override the earlier foundational legal text.
Now, we are going to meet a very specific character in this text who fiercely defends this rationalist view. Rabbi Yaakov Anatoly. Who exactly is he?
Rabbi Yaakov Anatoly is a really fascinating figure from the 13th century. He was a translator, a philosopher, and actually the son-in-law of the man who translated Maimonides' famous Guide for the Perplexed into Hebrew. So he's steeped in this rationalist tradition. And he wrote a book called Malmid HaTalmidim, which translates to The Goad of the Students.
The Goad of the Students. It sounds a little painful.
It is entirely meant to be. A goad is a sharp stick used to prod cattle to move forward. He explicitly wants to prod students out of their intellectual laziness. He represents the ultimate persona of the rationalist.
He's the guy poking you with a stick saying, think harder.
Exactly. He refuses to accept things just because they are popular or because everyone else believes them. He constantly wants to know, is this logical? Is it actually consistent with the unity of God? And he is the one who really leads the charge into the second major section of our deep dive today.
Which is probably the most spooky part of this whole discussion. We're talking about deconstructing demons. Let's get into Samael and Lilith.
This is where the text really pulls no punches.
Okay, so let's establish the popular belief first, just so we know what we're deconstructing. Even if you aren't deeply religious, you've probably heard these names floating around. Samael is usually known as the head demon, the fallen angel, the Satan figure.
Uh-huh.
And Lilith is his wife, the mother of demons, the terrifying night hag.
Right. In the mystical worldview, and honestly in a ton of modern pop culture too,
yeah.
These are very real, independent beings. They have wills, they have desires, they actively run a kingdom of impurity that is often called the Sitra Achra.
The other side.
Yes, the other side. They are the ultimate antagonists in the cosmic drama. God is on one side and they are on the other, trying to pull humans down.
And what does our rationalist source say about all of that?
It says they do not exist.
Period. Just like that.
Period.
Yeah.
Full stop. The source asserts that believing in them as independent conscious beings who can rebel against God or run some rival demonic kingdom is dualism. It's believing in two competing powers. And in Judaism, that is the definition of heresy.
But wait, I have to play devil's advocate here, no pun intended. The source totally acknowledges that these names actually appear in traditional Jewish texts. the Talmud mentions Samael. It explicitly mentions Lilith. So how does the rationalist explain that away? Because you just said their rule is the Talmud is the true tradition. You can't just say the Talmud is wrong.
You've hit on the exact tension. This is where the rationalist approach has to be incredibly sharp and clever. They don't ever say the Talmud is wrong. They say your reading of the Talmud is wrong. You're reading it like a child reading a fantasy novel.
Ah, okay. So how do they read it?
This brings us back to Rabbi Yaakov Anatoly and his philosophical sledgehammer. He starts by examining the very nature of angels.
Walk us through his logic on that, because angels are all over the Bible.
Right, but in the rationalist view, angels are not giant men with bird wings carrying flaming swords. They're what philosophers call separate intellects. They're entirely non-physical, spiritual forces created by God to perform very specific natural or cosmic tasks. The key here is they do not have bodies.
So if they don't have bodies, they don't have biology.
Exactly. They don't have hormones, they don't have brain chemistry, and therefore they do not have human emotions.
So they can't get jealous.
Bingo. Anatoly argues that jealousy is an entirely human trait. It comes directly from our physical nature, our lack, our desire for material things or for social status. How could a perfectly complete non-physical intellect possibly be jealous of a biological human made of dirt?
It's philosophically impossible.
Right. It makes zero sense. Therefore, the famous Midrashic story that the angel Samael was jealous of Adam's wisdom and rebelled and fell from heaven, Anatoly says it's a fairy tale. It cannot possibly be literally true. God does not create competitors, and angels cannot rebel.
That makes perfect logical sense if you accept the underlying premise about what an angel actually is. But then it begs the question, what is Samael then? If the ancient sages used that specific word, they obviously meant something by it.
Here is where the textual analysis gets really brilliant. The source breaks down the etymology of the name itself. The name Samael relates directly to the Aramaic word smael, and smael simply means left, or sometimes north.
Left. Okay, why is that significant?
Because in ancient biblical and rabbinic symbolism, the right side always represents wisdom, strength, Torah, and mercy. The left side, conversely, always represents weakness, deviation, or the evil inclination.
Oh, wow. So Samael isn't a guy with horns, it's a direction, or like a conceptual space.
It is a code word. The source concludes that when the sages talk about Samael doing this or that, they are allegorically talking about the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination. It is the human imagination. It's that internal voice inside your own head that tempts you to do something selfish or wrong.
So it's not an external monster hiding in the dark trying to get you. It's just your own internal struggle.
Exactly. That completely shifts the battlefield from the cosmic heavens down into the human heart. That is a massive theological shift.
It really is. It means you are responsible. You can't say, the devil made me do it. You have to say, my own left side got the better of me.
That is the defining characteristic of this rationalist approach. Radical personal responsibility.
Okay, so if Samael is just a metaphor for our own bad habits, what about Lilith? The source mentions she is often depicted as this terrifying night demoness who literally steals babies from their cribs. People used to put amulets in nurseries to keep her away.
To dismantle Lilith, the source goes all the way back to the Hebrew Bible, specifically to the book of Isaiah, chapter 34, verse 14. The actual word Lilith does appear there, but the rationalist says, look at the context. Don't just pull the word out. Read the whole sentence.
Look at the context.
Isaiah is describing a desolate wasteland, a ruined city, and he lists the creatures that will live there. He lists jackals, ostriches, snakes, and Lilith. It is clearly a list of desert animals. The word Lilith comes from the root, Lila, meaning night, or Yilala, meaning wailing. It refers to a nocturnal bird.
Like a screech owl.
Literally, yes. Most modern academic translations just say screech owl. The source argues that when the Talmud uses the term later on, for example, there's a passage describing a woman who grows hair like Lilith. It's just a mundane metaphor. It means she has long, unkempt hair that looks like the messy feathers of that specific wild bird.
So they took a metaphor about a bird's feathers and spun it into a demon.
Yes. Or sometimes it refers to literal night terrors, the psychological fear of the dark. But the source argues that uneducated people over the centuries took a poetic metaphor for a bird or a psychological fear, and they personified it into a literal demon woman flying around at night.
And the source claims this isn't just a silly mistake, but actually highly dangerous.
Extremely dangerous. Because if you genuinely fear Lilith, if you are doing rituals and writing amulets to ward her off, you are actively attributing power to something other than God. You are fearing a phantom. And in the strict rationalist view, fearing anything in the universe other than the creator is a crack in your monotheism.
Which flows perfectly into section 3 of our roadmap, the definition of foreign gods. Because I think most people hear the word idolatry and their mind immediately goes to the ancient world. They think of bowing down to a golden statue of a calf or offering grain to a stone idol. They don't think of, say, washing their hands at the dinner table.
Right. And this is where the source becomes incredibly sharp and relevant to modern practice. It redefines idolatry, or rather, it claims to be returning to the original, pure definition of Avodah Zarah. It argues that idolatry isn't just the physical act of bowing to statues, it is the mental act of attributing sovereignty or independent power to anything that isn't God.
So believing in the other side, the Sitra Achra, is technically idolatry.
According to this author, yes, without a doubt. The source viciously attacks the Kabbalistic concept that there is a side of impurity that needs to be appeased or quieted down. It argues that if you believe you need to give a portion of your actions to the forces of evil to keep them off your back, you are literally worshiping foreign gods. You are treating demons as a power that can be bribed.
The source gives some very specific examples of what it calls modern idolatry happening in observant communities. Let's talk about Mayim acronym, because this one blew my mind.
Yes, Mayim acronym. This is the widespread custom of washing your fingertips at the very end of a meal, right before you recite the grace after meals.
I've seen this done countless times at Friday night dinners. People pass around a little cup and a bowl, pour a splash of water on their fingers, and pass it on. It seems totally harmless.
And originally it was. The Talmud itself gives a very rational, purely physical reason for this practice. It has to do with something called sodomite salt.
What is sodomite salt?
In ancient times, there was a very harsh type of salt used to preserve food. And the sages warned that if you had the residue of this salt on your fingers after eating and you accidentally rubbed your eyes, it could literally blind you. So the rule was simple. Before you sit and pray, wash your hands to get the dangerous salt off.
So it's purely medical. It's ancient workplace safety.
100%. But the source points out that centuries later, the mystical tradition came along and added an entirely new supernatural reason for washing the hands. The Kabbalists started saying that you are washing off a portion of dirt and water to feed the Sitra Achra, to feed Samael.
So you're giving the demon a little snack so he leaves you alone while you pray?
Exactly. So that he doesn't prosecute you in the heavenly court. And our rationalist source just screams about this. It says, you are actively feeding a foreign god. It quotes the prophet Jeremiah saying, my people have exchanged their glory for that which does not profit.
It's like paying protection money.
It is exactly like paying the mafia. By performing a ritual explicitly to quiet a demon, you are honoring that demon. You are serving it. You are acknowledging that it has power over you.
Another crazy example the source brings up involves tefillin straps.
Right. Tefillin, the leather boxes and straps worn during morning prayers. There is a specific custom among some groups to let the straps of the head tefillin hang down a little bit outside the main knot.
And the rationalist reason for that?
The rational reason is purely technical. It's just how you tie the knot securely so the heavy box stays centered on your head. But the mystical reason, which the source quotes directly from Kabbalistic texts, says that you must let the hair or the strap stick out to appease the attribute of judgment, or Samael. You're giving him a tiny foothold on the outside of holiness so he doesn't attack the inside.
Again with the appeasement, bribing the bad guy with a piece of leather.
And the source asks a devastating theological question. Why on earth does God need you to bribe a demon? Is God Almighty not powerful enough to protect you while you are wearing his holy items? It calls this the partnership problem.
The partnership problem. I like that phrase.
The author argues you are creating a sick partnership between God and the devil. You worship God in the main sanctuary, but you pay a little protection money to the mob boss in the back alley just to be safe.
That is such a vivid way to frame it. And you can see why the author considers it an insult to God.
It's the ultimate insult to God's complete sovereignty.
The source also brings up a really fascinating psychological aspect of idolatry, which I found so poignant. It talks about the statue on the shoulder.
Yes, this is a beautiful piece of analysis citing the Midrashic text called the Sifri and the prophet Isaiah. It deeply mocks the ancient idol worshiper who has to physically carry his heavy wooden god on his shoulder. The god can't even move itself. You have to schlep it around everywhere. If it falls over, you have to pick it up.
Right. The irony of serving a god that requires you to do all the heavy lifting.
The source uses this image to mock those who believe in modern charms, red strings, and anti-demon rituals. You are carrying these fears around with you. They aren't carrying you. You are burdened by your superstitions.
There's a quote in the text, "Foreign gods are called foreign because they become strangers to their worshippers in times of need." That is a truly powerful line.
It means they don't actually show up when it counts. When the chips are really down, when you are sick or in real trouble, that red string on your wrist won't save you. The demon you've been bribing won't suddenly be nice to you. Only the creator of the universe exists, and only he can save you.
All right, so we've dismantled demons. We've totally redefined idolatry to include superstitions. Now we have to tackle what is perhaps the most controversial part of this entire text for a modern listener. This is section 4, the rejection of reincarnation. Gilgalim.
Yes, Gilgalim. This is where the text really goes against the grain of popular belief today.
I really think if you stopped the average person on the street, or even the average observant person, and asked them what Judaism believes about the soul after death, a massive percentage would say, oh, they believe you come back in another body until you get it right. It has almost become the default cultural setting.
It really has become the dominant view, but only in the last few centuries due to the massive spread of Kabbalistic literature. But our rationalist source slams the brakes on that completely. It explicitly labels reincarnation as a foreign, non-Jewish belief that infiltrated the religion.
And it doesn't just make that claim on its own. It brings in the heavy hitters to prove it, specifically Saadi Gaon.
Yes, Saadi Gaon. He is one of the absolute greatest of the Geonim, the head of the major academy in Babylon in the 10th century. He wrote a foundational book of Jewish philosophy called Emunot Vedayot, Beliefs and Opinions, and the source cites him directly. Saadi calls the belief in the transmigration of souls the idea that the spirit of Reuven dies and then enters the new body of Shimon. He calls it a madness and a total confusion.
Madness.
Wow.
He really does not mince words, does he?
Not at all. He argues that it makes absolutely no sense logically. He poses a sort of mathematical problem. If the soul of Reuven enters Shimon and then later enters Levi, who is the actual person, when the traditional resurrection of the dead finally happens at the end of days, who wakes up? Does that one soul have three different identities fighting inside it?
That sounds like a sci-fi nightmare.
Right. Saadi argues that the soul is created specifically with the body, for the body, and together they constitute one unique, unrepeatable identity. Reuven is Reuven forever. He is not a recycled version of someone else.
The source also draws a really surprising historical connection to ancient Egypt here.
I love this part. It provides such great historical context. The source argues that the ancient Egyptians were completely obsessed with the physical body. They mummified people and built massive pyramids precisely because they didn't believe the spiritual soul could exist independently without a physical vessel. They believed in a form of reincarnation that the soul would just jump into animals or other people if the original body wasn't perfectly preserved.
So the mummy was essentially an anchor to keep the soul from wandering.
Exactly. And the source argues that Judaism came into the world to oppose exactly that Egyptian worldview. Judaism teaches that the soul is eternal and purely spiritual. It doesn't need to hop from body to body just to exist. When the body dies, the soul stands before God completely on its own.
But the most compelling argument in the source, and honestly the one that scared me a little bit when I was reading it, is the philosophical argument regarding the second chance.
Ah, yes, the corridor argument.
Yeah, walk us through that, because the stakes are incredibly high.
The source brings a famous Mishnah from Ethics of the Fathers, Pirkei Avot. It says, "This world is like a corridor, and the world to come is the palace. You prepare yourself in the corridor so that you are ready to enter the palace."
Right. And the source basically points out that you don't go back into the corridor once you've crossed the threshold.
Exactly. Once you die, your work is permanently done. The text quotes Rambam writing about the absolute finality of death regarding the commandments. Rambam says that after death, there is no changing one's spiritual status. You cannot fix the soul after death. You simply are what you became during your lifetime.
That is terrifying. It completely removes the safety net that reincarnation provides.
It is entirely meant to be terrifying. It's a high-stakes theology. If you believe in reincarnation, you might secretly think to yourself, well, if I really mess up this life, or if I'm lazy, I'll just catch the next bus. I'll fix it in round two.
Right, it lowers the stakes of today.
Exactly. It makes you spiritually lazy. The rationalist view says, wake up. There is no next bus. This is it. This is your one and only shot at existence. Every single moment counts with infinite weight because it never, ever comes back.
But then, how does the rationalist explain the problem of suffering? Because, let's be honest, the classic, most comforting argument for reincarnation is theodicy. It answers the question, why do innocent babies suffer? The mystic says, well, it must be because they sinned in a past life. That seems to neatly solve the problem of God's justice.
The source addresses this exact question head-on, and it vehemently rejects that mystical explanation as a theological cop-out.
A cop-out. Why?
Because it directly contradicts an explicit principle written in the Torah itself. Fathers shall not be put to death for children, nor children for fathers. Every person is judged for their own actions, the principle of individual responsibility. The source argues that looking at a sick, suffering baby and saying, oh, they're suffering because they were a terrible sinner in a past life, is not only logically absurd since the baby has no memory of the sin and can't possibly learn or repent from it, but it is deeply, profoundly cruel.
You are looking at a suffering innocent and calling them a secret criminal.
Exactly. It's blaming the victim on a cosmic scale just to make yourself feel better about God's justice.
So what is the rationalist answer then? If not past lives, why do the innocent suffer?
The rationalist answer is much harder to swallow, and it requires tremendous humility. The answer is, we don't always know. God's justice is vastly beyond our human comprehension. Sometimes it's the result of natural law, sometimes it's hidden wisdom. But we cannot invent magical mechanisms like past lives just to make the cosmic math work out comfortably for our human brains.
This whole approach really strips away the comfort mechanisms of religion, doesn't it?
Yeah.
There are no demons to blame for your bad behavior. And there is no next life to fix your mistakes. You are totally exposed.
It puts the entire weight of existence squarely on the individual. Right here, right now, it is a theology of radical, unflinching responsibility.
Let's move into section 5, practical theology, because all of this philosophical theory actually changes how you live, how you practice, and how you pray on a daily basis. The source talks extensively about the Kaddish prayer.
Yes. The mourner's Kaddish is deeply, fundamentally misunderstood today, according to the source. Today, most people think of Kaddish as a prayer for the dead, a way to literally lift a soul out of Kenem, out of hell, or to give it a spiritual boost in the afterlife. You constantly hear people say, I need to say Kaddish for my father, as if they are doing something to him.
Right. It's treated almost like a transaction. I say these ancient Aramaic words, and dad gets a first-class upgrade in heaven.
And the source says this is a complete myth. It totally debunks it. It argues that Kaddish is not a magic spell. It says, just look at the actual words of the prayer. It never mentions death. It never mentions the soul. It doesn't say a single word about the afterlife. It is simply a public sanctification of God's name.
So if it doesn't help the dead person, what is it actually for? Why do mourners say it?
It is for the living. It is a profound psychological and theological tool called Tziduk Hadin, justifying the divine judgment. Think about it. The mourner has just suffered a terrible, heartbreaking loss. Their natural human instinct might be to curse God, to be angry, or to lose their faith entirely.
Which is completely understandable.
Completely. But instead of cursing God, the mourner stands up in the middle of the community and says, Yitgadav Yitgadash Me Rabba, may his great name be sanctified. They publicly declare that despite their immense pain, they still accept God's sovereignty. They still believe life has meaning.
It's an ultimate test of faith.
Exactly. It comforts the living community and justifies God's judgment. And as for the deceased, the merit they receive isn't from the magic syllables of the prayer. The merit is the fact that they successfully raised a child who remains faithful to God even in the depths of grief. That is their legacy.
That is so much more meaningful than treating it like a magic spell. And the source makes a very pointed argument about the language of Kaddish, too, right? Because it's written in Aramaic, not Hebrew.
Yes. People treat the Aramaic as if it's some mystical, highly potent language of the angels. Why was it written in Aramaic? Because that was the everyday street language the Jewish people spoke in Babylon at the time.
It was their English.
Right. The source points out the irony. It was intentionally written in the vernacular, specifically so the simple people would understand what they were saying. But today, people memorize it and recite it like a mystical incantation without knowing what a single word means. The source argues you can and probably should say it in Hebrew or English or whatever language you actually understand. Saying it as mumbo jumbo totally defeats the original purpose.
That makes total sense. Now, there's another practical topic the source hits hard, and that's the role of rabbis. We live in a world today that is full of wonder rabbis, miracle workers, charismatic leaders who claim to have an inside track with the Almighty.
And the source has absolutely zero patience for this entire phenomenon. It openly mocks the stories of great rabbis who claim to sit on the court of heaven.
The court of heaven? What is that?
There is a pervasive folk belief in mystical circles that truly righteous rabbis are invited to join God's divine tribunal. They help God decide cases, they can argue with the angels, they can veto decrees. The source looks at this and just scoffs. It quotes the Mishnah in Avot. He is the judge, he is the witness, he is the plaintiff. God is completely one.
So God doesn't have a board of directors.
Exactly. He doesn't need human consultants. He doesn't need advice.
So the idea that you can go to a rabbi, give them money, and they can sweeten a harsh judgment or completely annul a divine decree.
The source views that as bordering on idolatry. You are attributing divine powers to a mortal human being. In the rationalist framework, a rabbi is supposed to be a teacher of the law, a legal guide, an intellectual expert who helps you understand texts. But they are absolutely not a supernatural intercessor. You do not pray to a rabbi, and you do not rely on a rabbi to magically save you from your problems.
And what about the concept of Ruach HaKodesh, divine spirit or prophecy? Because people claim that all the time today. My rabbi has Ruach HaKodesh, he can read my mind, that sort of thing.
The source is extremely, intensely skeptical of all modern claims to that. The rationalist views true prophecy as an unbelievably high, almost impossible level of intellectual and spiritual perfection. It existed in biblical times for a few rare individuals, but the source views modern casual claims of "I see your soul" or "I have the Holy Spirit" as charlatanism, or at best, deep delusion. It contrasts the terrifying, heavy burden of the true biblical prophets with the casual, cheap, miracle-working claim today.
Okay, we've covered a huge amount of heavy theory.
Yeah.
But the text provides a really fantastic case study in section 6 that ties it all together. It takes a famous story from the Talmud that sounds completely supernatural and mystical, and it flips it entirely on its head. The story of Judah and Tamar.
Yes. This is an absolute masterclass in how to read texts allegorically. Honestly, if you understand this one example, you understand the entire rationalist methodology.
Set the scene for us. What is the biblical background here?
The text in question comes from Tractate Soda in the Talmud. The biblical story is incredibly dramatic. Tamar is a widow who is about to be burned at the stake for harlotry because she is pregnant out of wedlock. Judah, the leader of the brothers, is actually the father, but he hasn't admitted it publicly yet. She is being dragged out to die.
Oh, yeah, high stakes.
Extremely. But before this happened, she had secretly taken Judah's signet ring and his staff as collateral. So as she is being led out, she doesn't accuse him directly. She just sends him the ring and staff and says, "By the man whose these are, I am pregnant."
Wow.
Right. So Judah is put on the spot. He has a massive choice to make. He has to decide whether to admit his guilt and save her life, or stay silent, let her burn, and perfectly protect his own reputation and power.
So it's a profound moral crisis.
Okay.
But then the Talmud adds a really strange line to the story, right?
Yes. The Talmud says, at that exact moment, Samuel came and hid the signs, meaning the ring and staff, and Gabriel came and brought them near.
Okay, so let's play the literalist reader first. The literal mystical reading of that sentence is, there is an invisible demon named Samuel who is physically moving the physical ring and staff around the room to hide them. And then an invisible angel named Gabriel flies in to pull them back onto the table. It's literally like a cartoon with an angel on one shoulder and a devil on the other.
Right. It turns this profound human drama into a cheap magic show. And worse, it completely removes Judah's agency. If invisible forces are hiding the evidence, Judah isn't making a choice. It's just angels fighting each other. The rationalist source rejects this reading as childish and philosophically impossible.
So how does the rationalist actually read it?
Allegorically. Let's go back to our definitions. Samael represents the internal struggle, the Yetzer Hara. Why? Because Samael means left. It represents the left side of Judah's own consciousness.
So when the text says Samael hid the signs, it really means...
It means Judah's profound internal temptation was to ignore the evidence sitting right in front of him. He was repressing the truth. His own deep shame, his own ego, his selfishness was desperately trying to hide the reality from his conscience. He didn't want to look at the ring. He wanted to look away and let her die so he could remain pure in the eyes of the public.
Oh, that is so human. And what about the angel Gabriel?
Gabriel comes from the Hebrew words Gevurah El, which translates to God is my strength. Gabriel represents the triumph of the human conscience. It represents the immense moral courage required to admit the brutal truth. So when the text says Gabriel brought them near, it means Judah finally let the truth surface in his mind. He found the internal strength to look directly at the signs, accept the consequences.
And he finally says the famous words, "She is more righteous than I."
Precisely. The author of our source argues that if you read this as a story about invisible flying creatures moving objects, you entirely miss the point of the Torah. But if you read it as a deep psychological drama about the immense difficulty of admitting a mistake, it becomes a brilliant lesson in human morality. It's not about cosmic angel wars. It's about the brutal war inside Judah's own heart.
That is infinitely more powerful. And it feels so much more real. I mean, we've all felt that, Samuel. We've all felt that intense desire to hide the truth when we've messed up.
Exactly. And we've all desperately needed that Gabriel, that burst of internal strength to just own up to it. This whole reading perfectly encapsulates the mission of the rationalist source. It's trying to forcibly move us away from a childish world of external monsters and magic and move us toward a mature world of internal psychological responsibility and a direct, unmediated relationship with God.
So we have finally reached the end of our roadmap today. We've shattered the foundation of books that lie. We've deconstructed terrifying demons into psychological metaphors. We've redefined idolatry as trusting anything other than God. We've completely rejected the do-over of reincarnation. And we've grounded our religious practice in stark rationalism rather than magic.
It really is a sweeping, aggressive cleanup of the religion. It's like taking a house that has been covered in centuries of weird wallpaper and stripping the paint and paper all the way down to the studs just to see what actually holds the house up.
Let's summarize the big takeaways for the listener.
Hmm.
What is this source really demanding that we do?
First and foremost, it champions a total return to pure monotheism. There is one God. Full stop. There are no rivals. There is no other side. There are no demons you need to bribe or appease. It is just you and the Creator, nothing in between. A total rejection of fear-based theology. Do not fear the evil eye. Do not fear Lilith in the dark. Do not fear bad omens or curses. The source is saying, these things have absolutely no power over you unless you give them power in your own mind. If you truly feel nothing but God, you are completely and totally free.
And the third major takeaway.
Radical personal responsibility. This life is it. You are in the corridor right now. There is no reincarnation waiting to save you next time around. You have to do the hard work right now, today. You cannot rely on a wonder rabbi to magically fix your life for you, and you cannot rely on a future life to balance the scales. It infinitely elevates the importance and the stakes of this exact moment.
The source really leaves us with a heavy challenge. It asks the believer to critically examine their own customs and habits, to stop and ask, are you doing these things just because they happen to be written in a book somewhere, or because they actually align with the logical foundations of the Torah?
It quotes Maimonides one last time with this beautiful, striking line. He says, the eyes are in front, not in the back.
The eyes are in front.
Right. We have to look forward to the truth. We can't just blindly follow the errors of the past out of nostalgia. Just because your grandfather did a ritual doesn't mean it wasn't originally a pagan mistake inherited from the long exile. You have to use your mind.
Which leaves us with a really final provocative thought to chew on. If Maimonides the Great Eagle, the greatest philosopher and codifier of Jewish law, the Geonim, if they considered all these mystical beliefs to be errors or madness or even outright idolatry, how in the world did they become the dominant mainstream view in Judaism today?
That is the million-dollar historical question. How did the error win out over the truth?
Yeah. Why do we have red strings and anti-demon amulets and a widespread belief in reincarnation today if the absolute greatest minds in Jewish history explicitly called them madness?
It implies a really fascinating and maybe slightly depressing reality about the evolution of human religion. Maybe people just prefer the magic. Maybe people prefer the safety net of a second chance that reincarnation offers. It's deeply comforting. Rationalism is hard. It's intellectually cold. And it demands an awful lot from the individual.
The truth is often a lot harder to swallow than a good fiction.
Exactly. But as this aggressive source passionately argues, only the truth can actually save the soul. Comfort is nice to have, but comfort isn't salvation.
A whole lot to chew on today. This has honestly been one of the most intense, table-flipping deep dives we've ever done. Thank you so much for taking us through this theological minefield.
It was an absolute pleasure.
And to you, the listener, next time you pick up a religious book or perform a casual ritual, ask yourself, who are you really serving? The one God? Or the books of vanity? Until next time, keep diving deep.